Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, today my guest is Brad Thomas. Brad served over 20 years in the Army as an Army Ranger during the Battle of Mogadishu and later went on to the Delta Force. Brad has since left the Army and has pursued his passion of music to help other veterans, which we'll talk about later on in this episode. So welcome to the show, Brad.
Thank you very much for having me, man.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about your background. Why you got into the military? Did you always want to be in the military, or is this something that you kind of fell into somewhere along the line? How did that happen for you?
I had zero desire to be in the military. The time I was a little kid, I was in love with music and playing music and creating music. And my parents took me to see a whole bunch of live music when I was really young. And so, you know, that was kind of my passion. And all the way up until about the time that I was 12 and started reading books about Vietnam and Rangers in Vietnam and the war side of things started to really kind of excite me. And anyway, still was continuing to pursue music well into my late teens, very early 20s. And there was kind of a culmination of three things that happened December of 1989. One, the Rangers jumped into Panama and it was on TV. And it was like, wow, that's pretty cool. The band that I was in that was kind of, you know, in a position that it could have moved up and done something just kind of fell apart. And, you know, you're as strong as your weakest link. So, you know, I was in a situation where do I start over again and, you know, take two more years to build a group of guys to play music, or what do I do now? And the third thing was I had a buddy that had joined the Air Force, and he was home. I think it was his first time being home after he joined. And it was like on a Christmas, you know, leave or Christmas vacation, whatever you want to call it. And he told me about these guys that came around to recruit from his basic training class to rescue pilots that were, you know, trapped behind enemy lines. And it was like a special unit. And it was like kind of a combination of those three things that led me to the military, actually.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I always like to hear kind of a background story of where people fell into what they ended up doing in the military, because it's never the path that you always think that you're going to take. You know, You started off, you know, with your passion for music, and then you know, next thing you know, here's this guy talking about rescuing down pilots and all that kind of stuff, and you totally change your mindset on that. So
once I was 18 and registered with Selective Service, then the Army recruiters would, you know, the military recruiters would just start calling, you know, hey, right, what are you looking to do? What are you? And the Army guy was like pressuring me hard to like join and be in the Army band. And I'm like, yeah, dude, I don't think that you guys play the kind of music that I play. So I don't think that that's even, he's like, well, what do you like to play? And I'm like, well, I'm in a thrash metal band and, you know, it's been going for a few years now. So he's like, well, you know, we have a band that tours and does all this stuff. And, you know, anyway, it wasn't of interest to me. So I blew that guy off, you know, every time he would call.
Yeah. So what got you into going into the Army Rangers and eventually into the Delta? But what about the Rangers where you started off?
Sure. So I originally, because my buddy was in the Air Force and I literally knew nobody that was in the military, nobody from my family had been in the military. None of my extended relatives were in the military. So I was completely, kind of sheltered from what that was and what it was like. So I went to the Air Force recruiter and he and I went back and forth for probably a month, and he flat out was lying to me. And actually signed the paperwork, and with the premise that he was going to give me some sort of contract to guarantee the right that I could try for this special unit. And so he told me, well, if you sign, then I can work a contract for you, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, I was leaving his office one day after, again, about a month of kind of every week going up there and arguing with the guy and everything else. And I just didn't want to, I didn't know how it worked. So I thought, like, in the middle of basic training, they're like, hey, you're a good cook. You're going to Alaska to flip burgers, you know, like, I didn't want to do that. So anyway, I was leaving one day and the Army recruiter pulls me aside and he said, hey, man, what are you doing? What's going on over there? And I said, well, I signed up, but the guy won't give, you know, he won't give me a contract. He said he would, and he's not. And he goes, well, what do you want to do? I can give you a contract today. And I said, I don't know, like Delta Force. And he was like, okay, you can't do that. You got to do something first, like Special Forces. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And he goes, well, you can't do that either. You got to do something first, like a Ranger. And that's literally how it started.
Okay. So it was a bit of a crash course in you know, Army MOSs and, you know, how to get into the military, which I got to imagine is not the most common thing to know about either, you know, for other, you know, 17, 18, 19 year old kids who are trying to join the military, unless they knew someone who was in the military, they probably didn't know about that either. And so recruiters probably could pull a fast one on you if they wanted to, yeah, you know, to get you in there.
That was also at a time when the military wasn't looking for people.
Right.
They were very selective and there were drawdowns and everything else. I mean, even though Panama had happened, we weren't at war, you know, so they could be very selective about who they chose. So it was, don't say that you use drugs. If you've got any alcohol related offense, you're not getting in. If you've got any criminal activity, you're not getting in, and et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, that was kind of the start point.
Yeah. And that's a big difference to, you know, fast forward post 9/11, where they were at a point at some years where they're accepting just about everybody. And
it's like tattoos, you know, exactly. total criminals and everything else.
Yeah, exactly.
The same thing happened. So I joined in May of 90. That's when I actually signed up. That summer, Desert Shield kicked off. And so all of a sudden we were ramping up, sending all kinds of troops over to Kuwait, you know, as a staging area for what would become Desert Storm. And so over that summer, I joined in May. I couldn't get in until November of 90. And over that summer, the floodgates opened because they realized they needed more people. And so they let everybody, anybody and everybody in. So by the time I got to basic training in November of 90, it was exactly that. It was like there was a criminal element. There was, you know, all kinds of characters there that probably had no business being in the service.
Right, right. So you go through basic training and then I mentioned earlier in the episode, you were in the Battle of Mogadishu, which most people probably think about the book and the movie Black Hawk Down, you know, from that time period. Obviously, once when Hollywood gets their hands on something, you know, that you're getting a different version from what actually happened. But not to take away from the movie, because it was a great movie, but I'd like to hear what happened during that time period from your perspective.
Well, again, I think whenever people ask me about Mogadishu, I kind of have to start at the beginning, and without making it a long-winded thing, I try and generally give people information that they don't know. They don't know from the movie or the book. It wasn't things that was included in that or just kind of basic facts about, you know, people think one thing and it's actually another, but you know, I try and remind people that it was a peacetime military. Most of the people that I served with were one term, you know, a four-year contract. They were in for college money, and the GI Bill was a very attractive thing for people that couldn't afford to go to school. So people were signing up all over the place to, you know, get their college paid for and things like that. So we weren't led by warriors. We were led by people that, you know, I think even at the most senior level, most of the Vietnam people had moved on by then. So anyway, it was just a different flavor. When I talk about the actual Mogadishu mission and the things that we were doing, I try and, you know, explain as an example you know, nowadays you go out to do a patrol, everybody has a radio, you know, you've got multiple things overhead that you can tap into to give you situational awareness. There was nothing. There weren't, you know, individual radios. Once the bullets started to fly, you know, you can't communicate verbally. We didn't have peltors. We didn't even have earplugs. So you're talking about a volume of fire and RPG explosions and things like that, that it made communicating completely impossible. So there was no real game plan for that. What happens if this? How are we going to disseminate, you know, information to our subordinates, or, you know, to get the battle moving, to get people to go from one place to the other, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was a very chaotic, you know, most people didn't know what was going on from moment to moment. And, you know, people were getting shot, people were getting killed, and all of that was kind of happening at the same time. So the majority of my time on the ground, I literally didn't know what I was doing other than trying to engage people that I knew were definitely trying to, you know, engage us.
That's interesting, because I've always thought that communication is one of like the greatest assets that you have in the military. Being able to communicate, whether it's with another ground force, on the ground with you fighting in the same battle, or even to air assets, be it, you know, helicopters or, aircraft or, you know, other things like that. The ability to communicate is huge. You know, if you don't have that, that's a definite big problem. And it sounds like that was probably a primary problem for you guys on the ground, right?
For sure. And I don't think that because of where we were as a military that we even knew enough to say, you know, let's develop a contingency in case this happens. I think it was, you know, we do live fire training, we do things like that, and the leaders are giving verbal communication and nonverbal communication, and even at nighttime we've got a means to, you know, signal our position or whatever it might be, things like that. And all of a sudden we're in an environment in the middle of the streets, in the middle of the city, and, you know, the entire city seemingly is against us. And so what do? We jump over the wall and get inside of a, you know, a building and fortify that and hold it down until we can get, you know, other troops there? What, you know, what's the plan? And so we didn't even really have a contingency plan. And, you know, again, it's not that we went in half cocked. It was that the military wasn't in a place back then like it is now. It wasn't an experienced war fighting machine.
Yeah. The other thing that I found interesting watching the movie, and I'm sure it was different in real life, but from the movie, one of the things that I took away was looking at the individuals who were fighting against the Americans. It was another one of those situations, just like Afghanistan and Iraq, where the combatants were not wearing uniforms. They were not clearly identified as, these are the bad guys. They're wearing this. You know, they blend in with the civilian population just like anybody else. And, that I can imagine would be kind of a shock as well to somebody who's going over there.
I think the Rangers at that time were very, you know, we were a very hard, physically disciplined, mentally tough group of, you know, kids, for the lack of a better term. But, you know, we were really a young group of kids that was running around that had been put through a lot of physically and mentally challenging training. But as an example, not knowing what you don't know, like I was never educated about law of the land warfare. What if there's a woman in the middle of the street that's pointing out your position to enemy fighters? So we were very good at making people quit that weren't mentally and physically, you know, hard as nails, but we weren't really training and educating our troops the way that we should have been had we really know what we were doing. And so that's, you know, it's hard to just say, hey, Mogadishu, the battle, right? Without understanding the mind frame of where people were. So when I was in that situation, all I could think was, man, don't make me have to do this. Like, hey, woman, you know, and crowd of people and men and women all mixed together. And okay, do I just let everybody shoot my guys and us? Or, you know, how do I deal with this situation? And so even after the fact, nobody, because there wasn't any sort of PTSD counseling, there wasn't any sort of, you know, exit, you know, hey, what did you think of your deployment? You know, there wasn't any of that stuff. Most of the guys went on to think that they had done criminal things, or, you know, that there were things that happened that weren't necessarily, you know, to spec. And, you know, that's an example too of, you know, again, I think that guys going overseas now probably have a lot better of an idea. Not that I know where they're going right now, but, you know, they probably have a lot better idea of those types of things than we did back then.
Yeah, I know before I went to Afghanistan that there were briefings on briefings on briefings of everything from their culture and other, you know, language type things and, you know, rules that we were supposed to follow as far as, you know, rules of engagement and all that kind of stuff. So stuff that you were talking about, which was sort of confusing over there, you know, we did cover a lot of that. And so that might have been a lesson learned from that experience where you guys went over there and weren't really sure. And, you know, hopefully the leadership learned from that and pass that on to, you know, the future generations. So that way we didn't have to deal with that problem where we're second guessing ourselves, you know, can I pull the trigger or whatever, you know, we actually had a whole, checklist of things that we had to do before we could pull the trigger. And it was like, kind of like ingrained in our heads that we knew like what we were supposed to do. And, you know, so yeah, I mean, even things like you're talking about an unarmed, you know, person who's pointing out your position to the enemy fighters, like, you know, what do you do? You know, how do you stop that? You know, that's a tricky thing, you know?
For sure. You know, just dealing with people, are we flex cuffing people? Are we allowed to, you know, what are those types of things? And much later in my career, when I got to Delta, that was a completely, you know, you're getting a briefing from everybody, you know, the legal aspect of things, you know, define kill capture, define the ROE, you know, to an nth degree so that you knew exactly what you could and couldn't do. And we would talk about different situations, and then our training mirrored that too. So, you know, right. We wouldn't just, hey, hear this stuff. We would actually go out and practice a lot of it. So we had the ability to do that. And that was a great thing.
So when you went to the recruiter and you said you wanted to go Delta Force, and he's like, well, you can't do that. And then, you know, you got to start low and work your way up. So you were in the Rangers when you went over to Somalia. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So then eventually you decided you wanted to try for the Delta. Is that, and so how did that progression take place?
Well, it was, you know, I was actually talking about this earlier. I did a podcast with like the official SOCOM, like CSM and all those folks, which is actually really cool. But we talked a lot about kind of the professional development piece and how that moved along. But again, being kind of an idiot as to how the military worked and everything else, first of all, I expected the Rangers to be something a little different than what it actually ended up being. And that kind of happened to me my whole career. I would get to a place and I would think, okay, this is going to be the thing that I think it's going to be. And it never really, you know, fully met my expectations. And my expectations may have been completely unrealistic based on things that I had seen in Hollywood or on, you know, movies or read about or whatever it might have been. But I realized very quickly when I got to the Rangers that even though my ultimate goal was to be a Delta Force operator, I can't just get there. Like, I have to be the best that I can be at what I'm doing right now today. So when I walked into the Rangers, as an example, you know, you've got about 6 to 12 months before they send you to Ranger school, which is a prerequisite to be a team leader or in any sort of leadership position in the Ranger regiment. So, okay, now they're basically preparing me mentally, physically, to be able to do, you know, my job there as a brand new Ranger, but also to prepare me to go to Ranger school and be able to successfully complete that. So thinking about what I need to do to be in Delta Force is nowhere in my lexicon at that point. And it just turned into, I just need to be as good as I can be right now today. So when I talk about, you know, the progression of what it took to get to, you know, the elite level military, first of all, I tell people, like, being tier one doesn't mean you're better than anyone else. Being in a tier one unit really just has to do with your recall status, how soon you can be out the door if something happens, and how you're funded. And so the funding on the tier one side isn't something public. So people can't see where or what dollars are being spent on or things like that. So, you know, it doesn't mean better. It doesn't mean that because I'm in Delta Force, I'm better than somebody else. It doesn't mean any of that. But I liken it to the NFL. And I think that's just an example that most people understand, right? So in Brad's brain, when Brad went to the recruiter, Brad was like, hey, I just want to be in the NFL. And the guy was like, well, wait a minute. Did you play peewee football? You know, did you play high school football? And so I would kind of correlate the Rangers as being like, you know, kind of Division A high school football. And then I went to the recon detachment, which was a smaller group of more highly trained and special skills group of, you know, maybe about 20 guys. And that was kind of like the college level football. And so, you know, you don't just go to the NFL. You've got to do a whole lot of work before that, years and years. So I got to Delta Force selection with 8 years in the military, and that's probably pretty average. I think, you know, under that, there are not a lot of those guys. I got there probably on the early side of, you know, how long it takes. Most people are like in that 8 to 12 year window. So you're talking about people that have been around the block. They've done stuff, whether, you know, nowadays they're deploying with other units, they're doing a lot of those things. But, you know, it took a lot of sacrificing and a lot of hard work and a lot of being really good at being a Ranger to get to that next level. So if you can't perform here, you're not going to perform there.
Interesting. Yeah. And, you know, that progression is true in a lot of things too, you know, and even just in the Army in general, they have the crawl, walk, run phase for things. And, you know, you don't start off running, you know, on a live fire range when you've never shot a weapon before. You have to start off in that crawl phase and learn the fundamentals and learn, you know, how to do all that stuff. So that way you can crawl and then walk, and then you can run somewhere down the line. So same thing, it seems like, you know, with that career progression. And, you know, I think that probably applies to a lot of things in life too, where sometimes people will see the success stories. It looks like it's an overnight success where this person's business takes off and it's flourishing and they're doing great. And they're like, oh, well, I want to be that guy. You know, I want to flip the switch and automatically have this multi-million dollar business. But what they don't see is all the hard work, all the years and years of maybe even failures or, you know, other hard work that went into them getting to that stage. And so sometimes things are disheartening to see someone else be so successful and not realize how unsuccessful they had to be in order to be that successful, you know?
Yeah, everybody wants to be the next Post Malone and YouTube viral sensation without putting in the years of, you know, hard work that it takes to get, you know, that level of ability and talent and everything else, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Kind of a lot of our culture today is very much that, you know, like, I just want to skip to the front of the line. And even I was in that same, you know, basically, and what I told the recruiter was, you know, hey, I'm ready to be in the NFL.
Yeah.
But I wasn't.
No, exactly. Yeah. No, you thought you were and you wanted to be there. And it sounded great. You know, it sounded like, you know, the kicking in the doors and doing all the cool stuff sounded like it was awesome. And that's exactly what you wanted to do. But, you know, the recruiter knew and you know, other people knew too, that you just weren't ready for that. And looking back now, I'm sure you realize that you weren't ready for that either at that point in your life, you know?
Exactly. You know, it was, That's why I say it was a little bit disappointing when I got there, and it was like, okay, I was expecting it to be more of the, you know, more of something or whatever it might have been, but it was also a good reality and sanity check, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up too, because it does make a lot of sense. And I think people, especially getting out of the military, people who might've done their 4 years or their 10 years or 20 years, whatever they've done in the military, they might think that they could just hit the ground running in, you know, on top of a corporate ladder or wherever they decide to go. But, you know, sometimes they might need to have a little slice of humility there and take it down a notch and say that, you know, maybe they're not quite ready for that top level. Maybe they need to take a step back and see what it's like in the civilian world, in the corporate world, or whatever they're getting into before they can accelerate and move up that ladder, you know?
I also think we're kind of at a unique time with the number of deployments a lot of guys have and gals have from the service. And it became, you know, in my mind, it kind of became like a metric for how good someone was like, oh, that guy's got 18 deployments, or this guy's got 12 deployments. Like I know people that are, you know, every bit of that. And, you know, I try and tell the younger people as they're getting in, and now we're kind of, you know, toning back from war and the deployments and everything else, but the corporate world, the business world, the music industry, you name it, like they don't care how many people you killed or how many deployments you went on or, you know, what awards you have or anything else. And, you know, the same thing applies everywhere else in life that it does. You've got to start someplace and you've got to work and sacrifice to get, you know, to the next level, whatever that might be for you.
Yeah, no, for sure. Absolutely. So I briefly mentioned earlier in the episode that you're now pursuing your passion of music. And you talked a little bit about how you were into music before the military. When you were in the military, did you keep up with the music that you were into, or did it kind of like fade away while you're in the military and then you picked it up later? How did that progress?
I didn't have the time to, you know, devote to it that I did prior to, but when I initially joined, I basically got rid of, or I think I had my parents sell all my stuff. I tried to get rid of it and sell it to, you know, friends and things like that. And about 6 months into my time in the Rangers, you know, all the people that I was serving with at the time, they knew that I played music and music was a huge part of just me. And I was in a bar, and one of my buddies, you know, whether he was trying to call me out or put me on the spot, I think he knew, you know, that I could play, and maybe I had a guitar and an amp, you know, some stuff then. But he went and told the band that, you know, hey, this guy, almost like Make-A-Wish, right? Like, hey, this guy just wants to, you know, be up on stage and play one song before, you know, he dies of cancer or whatever. It was almost like that type of thing. So I'm drinking and I'm at the bar, and all of a sudden, and I hear the band calling my name, and, you know, hey, come to the stage, come on. I'm like, what the hell is going on? So I go up to the stage, and me and the guys, you know, talk a little bit, you know, hey, what songs, you know, what do you know? What do you know? That kind of thing. And we played a tune, and, you know, by the end of it, people were like shaking my hand and like going crazy and all that. So that kind of fueled the whole thing. And there were also some things musically, you know, the soundtrack of our lives at that time in a very unstable, uncertain environment. The soundtrack was, you know, Alice in Chains and Nirvana and Stone Temple Pilots and all this really great Soundgarden, all this really great, powerful music that's still pretty powerful and endures. And, you know, that was something that I didn't really necessarily understand the mark that it made on me then. I was still into, at that time, I was still into, you know, the mid-80s thrash metal stuff, and that had kind of faded out, and grunge and other stuff had taken over MTV and all of that. So anyway, that was kind of how I started the whole rekindling process.
And so after getting out of the military, how did you get back into into music and start up a band and all that kind of stuff? How did that happen? And, or did it just sort of, you know, fall into it? Were you expecting it to happen, or was it something that you just came out of the blue?
So I think early 2000s, I started accumulating more gear and guitars and, you know, things like that, and had a little more time to be able to devote to it and things like that. So in between deploying and other stuff that I was doing, you know, I had downtime that I could spend and dedicate to doing that. So by the time the mid 2000s came around, I was playing in bands in Fayetteville and ended up, 2007 to say 2010 was actually in a band that was opening for all the national acts that came through Fayetteville. And so got to open for, like Seven Mary Three and Evans Blue and I'm trying to think, Vanilla Ice was one of them, although I didn't get to play that show. But all the national acts that were coming through there, we would get to play with. And that was really kind of like, okay, I'm back in this. I need to do something. It was original music. It wasn't my original music. And then it came time for me, by 2010, came time for me to kind of separate and, you know, move to where I was going to move. And I moved to New York, and then I kind of started the whole thing over again there.
Okay. So the band you're in now, what's the name of the band?
Silence and Light.
Silence and Light. Okay. So tell us about that, how that came about, and you know, how that band formed and what it is that you're doing now, as far as, you know, with veterans and everything like that.
Sure. So, after 2010, for a handful of years, I was just enjoying doing what I was doing and, you know, having fun and meeting people and hanging out and all that kind of jazz. And, you know, my wife and I, she would see this accumulation of music equipment and be like, you know, it's a shame you're not doing something with this. And at the same time, you know, I wasn't necessarily struggling, but definitely, you know, that sense of purpose that I had when I was in the military, just, it wasn't as strong. Like, what am I doing? How, you know, how can I fix whatever it is? You know, there's veteran suicide that's, you know, skyrocketing, and there are all kinds of things. Do I start a foundation? Do I run for president? You know, what is it? And so my wife finally, you know, I already said it, but she was like, it's a shame you're not doing something with this. And it didn't dawn on me then, but the next day I was traveling into New York City and to meet my buddy, Jason Everman, who was a Ranger, served about the same time that I did, and then went on to be a Special Forces guy and did some other stuff. He played in both Nirvana and Soundgarden prior to joining the military. And he and I had been friends for a long time. I was going to meet him and we were going to go to a Mastodon concert. And beforehand, we're at the bar and having some cocktails. And they just said, you know, hey, man, I want to do this thing. I want to start a music project, whatever it is. If it's a band, it's a band. It's me and you, whatever. I want to do something. And I want to take the proceeds from that and contribute those to veteran and first responder charitable organizations. I don't want to stand up a foundation and ask people for money. I don't want to, you know, I just want to be able to do this and also kind of be an example to guys that are struggling and guys and gals that are struggling and looking for some sort of purpose to say, hey, if I can do this with all of the baggage that I've got from deploying, if I can do it, you can do it too. So that's really how it started. I stood up a social media page and then it kind of grew organically where each of the guys that ended up coming into the band, you know, was we connected through social media. We would get together in person, kind of hang out and feel each other out. And, you know, all right, can you play? Can you, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that's really how it grew, all the way to the point of having a multi Grammy award winning producer contact us and say, hey, I want to help out. What can I do? And, you know, that was an awesome experience. So we're getting ready to launch our second album and, you know, get all that recorded and finished up and, you know, drop that. And hopefully the same deal. If people buy a song, we're taking the proceeds of that, 100% of the proceeds from that, and we're giving them to two different special operations, veterans, first responder, charitable organizations.
So So all of, you're saying all the proceeds from those songs go to the to these special operation nonprofit organizations that directly help these veterans who they support, right?
Yep, 100%.
So 100%. So to the listeners, if you didn't catch that, 100% of the money for these sales go to helping out veterans. So you know, definitely check it out. I'm gonna have links to all of this stuff in the show notes too, so that you guys can go check out all this stuff and support veterans, support Brad and his band and his music, and help out the veterans and listen to some great music along the way too. You know,
if people ask all the time, how can they, you know, help and contribute to the band? First of all, I'll tell you, you know, our first album cost about $35,000 to record. And that came out of, you know, our collective pockets. But, you know, that's everything from hotel to travel to rehearsal time and hotels and travel for that, to the recording costs of studio and paying engineers and paying mixers and everything else. So, you know, we're basically saying we're putting in the money. All you've got to do is buy it, and we're going to take 100% of that and give back. But if people want to help the band, they can get on our website, through our social media, through, you know, Google us. You can find us everywhere. And if you buy merchandise, that's something that we're using to help recoup some of the costs and be able to at least, hey, maybe we make enough so that we can pay for the studio and mastering or, you know, things like that. But it's a music business for a reason. It's a business. And it's not free.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. So things like t-shirts and hats and all that kind of stuff go to help support you guys, so that all of this costs us, you know, seems pretty expensive to, you know, lay out that money on your own.
And sell a lot of t-shirts to recoup that. And the last thing I'll say, at least, you know, before we sign off, is the different charitable organizations that we're contributing to, there are two. One of them is called Warrior's Heart. And you can check out warriorsheart.org, but it's a physical facility in Texas. And I think they're actually getting ready to stand up a second one. It's not just for veterans. It could be for first responders. It could be from, you know, people that were helping fight the COVID battle and things like that, that have just lived through, you know, stuff and have post-traumatic stress. And the reason that I love Warrior's Heart is that it's kind of a holistic approach on how they help people that are struggling. Number one, you know, PTSD isn't usually just, you know, something going on in somebody's head. It's tied up in a big ball of nasty shit, like alcohol abuse or drug or, you know, substance abuse of some sort. And so they get people clean, they help people get, you know, get clean, they start PTSD counseling, and then they use art as a form of therapy. And I absolutely love that, because, you know, when I play the guitar, I'm in that flow state. It's the only thing I can do aside from maybe cooking or grilling, that I just am kind of doing my thing, and I don't have anything else in my head. And so it could be sculpting, it could be welding a huge thing, it could be painting, artwork, writing, music, you name it. But they use that as a form of therapy. And that really resonated with me. So that's one of the organizations. The other is Marine Raider Foundation. And that really started because one of my bandmates is a former MARSOC Raider, and they directly contribute to, you know, the fallen, families of the fallen. And if they need to get travel across the country to attend memorial services or need hotels paid for, that type of thing, they take care of all of that. So that's what we're doing. That's who we're contributing to. And I don't think for the next album, I don't think we're going to change who we're contributing to, so it should still hold up by the time the album releases.
No, that's awesome. And those sound like two great organizations to be supporting. And you mentioned how, you know, Warrior's Heart, how they use art therapy as, you know, the form of counseling or therapy that they do there. And you mentioned how, you know, when you're playing the guitar, you're in that state, you know, that kind of flow state where you're just not worried about, you know, other things in the world, and you're there playing guitar, kind of present in the moment.
It's like my pacifier.
You say that probably jokingly, but you know, it's almost like that, you know, where, you know, cause I've done the same thing where I would, you know, pick up a paintbrush and I start painting, and, next thing you know, a couple hours have gone by and like, I don't even realize it because I'm just so focused in that moment. And, you know, some people may not think that, you know, art, whether it's music or, you know, welding or sculpting or painting or, whatever it is, they may not think that is something that's going to work for them, but I just say, give it a try, you know, and try different things too, because, you know, one form of art may not resonate with you, but another one might, you know, it's definitely something worth trying, especially if you're having trouble, you know, kind of focusing, staying in that present, in that moment. You know, it's really a great opportunity to, help yourself really and create cool stuff in the process too. Right.
And you don't know how it's going to connect with other people. And that's that to me has been one of the unintended consequences of releasing music, is the number of people that hit me up and say, man, I heard that song and God, did it connect with me? And I'm in the middle of the gym on the treadmill and started crying when I heard it, you know. It was just this release. But to hear people say things like that, or I just love the way this things make, you know, makes me feel when I listen to it, or whatever it might be. So, you know, that's an unintended consequence, but we're glad that it does connect with people, you know. The other thing I'll say, and where I'll kind of leave off, is, you know, I didn't start this so that I could be like famous rock star guy or anything else. I like my quiet life and everything else. And ultimately I became the person doing all the media and all the talking and everything else. So the reason I put myself out there publicly was so that other people could say, man, that guy's been through, you know, I deployed 8 times from Mogadishu all the way through, you know, multiple times at the GWAT. And, you know, I've got a lot of damage. I've got a lot of trauma and things that I lived through and dealt with and lived the dark days and everything else. And if I can find purpose in giving back to the community that I served in and that I loved so much, it's super fulfilling. And I can tell people that if they find something or a way to give back or a way to contribute, they're going to feel a whole lot better about, you know, the whole experience. But the whole point of me being public about it was to say, if I can do this, you can do it too, because I'll put my combat resume up against anybody's and, you know, the things that I lived with and dealt with. So, you know, I wanted to be an example, and the Rangers have the whole, you know, Rangers lead the way and lead by example, you know, not do as I say, you know, that kind of thing. You know, so I wanted to be that person and say, look at me, use me as an example of someone that you can try and emulate that way.
And I think that's a great, great place to close. And I think that message is really perfect for the listeners of this podcast. You know, we try to make sure that people know that they're not alone, and that there's other people who have gone through similar things, and that there is a way to come out better, you know, on the other side. And sometimes it's just a matter of finding that sense of purpose. You know, you might lose that after you get out of the military, and, you know, by finding some way to give back like you're doing, or, you know, like what I'm doing with this podcast, or, you know, what thousands of other people have found to do to give back to other veterans, or, just their communities, you know, other things that you could do, you know, find something that gives you a sense of purpose, makes you feel good, you know, and passionate about what you're doing. And once you have that, there's no stopping you, you know, and I really, truly believe that. So
just being healthy, positive, creative, you know, it doesn't fix all your problems, doesn't solve all your problems, but it starts you down a path that's a very, you know, healthy, positive, and creative thing. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, Brett, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. You said you had a website. I'd like to have you mention what the website is and any social media handles you might have before we close this out, just so people know where to find you.
Sure. So Silence and Light Official on Instagram, Brad Thomas Official on Instagram, I think I've got a Facebook. We've got a Facebook page for Silence and Light. We've got a website, which is silenceandlightmusic.com. We've got CDs that we're selling on Amazon. So if you're a person that likes a physical copy of something, you can get CDs on Amazon. You can stream our music anywhere you would stream it. It's on every music channel known to man. So if people, I try and tell them this, like if you sell a song on iTunes for 99 cents, you don't get 99 cents. You get about 63 cents. And so, you know, when you buy something, that's obviously contributing a lot greater than streaming something. And if, unless you're streaming in the millions, it's not a really lucrative thing. So, you know, we try and encourage people to buy it, but we also didn't want to make people buy it. We'd rather people be able to have it and access it. And those that get the point, you know, go on and buy it. If you don't want to buy it, stream it. We don't care. You know, you're contributing either way.
Wonderful. Yeah. So definitely, you don't have to buy it, but buy it. That's coming from me. Brad's not telling me to say that at all. You don't have to buy it, but buy it. So thanks again, Brad, for coming on the show, sharing your story, and showing that there is hope for people who are struggling, who have had a tough time, and that they can find a sense of purpose of their own, and come out with a better life afterwards. You know,
absolutely. And thank you for having me on. Thanks for letting me come on your platform, and thank you for what you're doing in helping get the word out, you know, for people like me too. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
All right, dude.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.